While you guys are just getting yourself settled back in here, basically we have an astronomical theme today, so I wore my lucky astronomy t-shirt, and you can see that there's been some incredible pictures on there. Most of them, not all of them, are the ones I've taken myself. You can always tell which ones aren't mine. When this one was taken on Mars, you can tell I wasn't there. So what we're going to do over the next 2 days is basically go through a journey together. Now, let me just get rid of this beastie in a second and start this beastie. Good. All righty. As Richard said, I'm going to talk about general relativity. And I'm not going to talk about general relativity. It's on. Oh, anybody would like to buy a BlackBerry?
How much?
No, so far I've got 5. Do I hear 10, 7, 10? Sold for $170.
Wait, no.
There we go. So I'm going to talk about general relativity, and this is probably the best way to get it out there. Now, we're going to have a break today, and then I'm going to continue tomorrow, another break. And if I get done, I've got a great way of introducing the concept of curvature without using a sphere, a totally different way. And it was that technique that I introduced. You remember my little characters? Albert Einstein, which you may see appear over here, and Sir Isaac Newton. So that'll be that. Now, in the Mark's little lecture there, when he was talking a bit about dark energy, those of you who've got your thumb drives, bring your thumb drives on Friday. I've got one slide to pop on because he talked about something called the Big Rip, right? He just mentioned it, so I'll put an extra slide or two to explain what that's all about. And those of you who want a copy of what dark matter is, what dark energy is, in English, that touches about a bit of the mathematics, so it gets you gut feeling of what this thing's all about, you can get a copy of that, okay? Now, when I get to talk about this, everybody usually asks me, well, is there a good resource for studying this stuff? Because you have one or two things. It's either you open up a magazine and it's too weeny, right? There's a picture almost like that, right? And, or you encounter an article where it's Greek to you, right? There's just too many symbols, and you have no clue. And you know that you have some math background, but you don't have 4 years, 5 years of university tensor calculus behind you. So, one of the best books I recommend, and I will probably put the end number on there, it's called Gravity from the Ground Up. And it's written by a gentleman by the name of Schutz. And I will put the name, and I will put the ISBN number there for those of you who are interested. It assumes that you have a nice, decent high school level of mathematics, and you're not afraid to delve a bit into basic calculus. But it explains everything in detail and uses mathematics as a bit of the tool, but non-abstract mathematics. You know, so it's a really good way to walk out of here and say, you know what? I understand why it works from a verbal sense, but I understand how it works from a mathematical sense. And it's a really good. So I will put this, make this available on the board for sure. So anybody who wants it, just let me know. Once you've done that, you can go to the introductory book on general relativity, and that's this beastie. Okay. This is nearly any cosmologist or any scientist who studies general relativity usually has one of these someplace, right? And you can see that we're going to try and talk about this in a couple of hours. Oh, and it does have. It does have some pictures. There's a picture. It has a lot of math. right? No, not in color. But some of the people I want to mention is Meisner, Thorn, and you will hear these guys, and a gentleman by the name of Wheeler. So I'm going to take us on a journey about black holes. And this journey is going to be a magical journey because one of the most important things you need to learn as a young physicist is you need to understand where these ideas came from. It's not just important to know how to write F equals MA. It's also important to know where that came from, right? You almost have to know the enemy, experience what they went through. And that's one of the things that you should be encountering in school. You're repeating some of the experiments that took place due to Newton. I'm going to take us on a journey basically from the beginning. And once we are done, we should be almost at the current understanding of these objects called black holes. So as we go through this, pay attention, try to think, appreciate what went through, because I'm going to provide this for you. I'm going to give you a package. It'll be available after today, and you know, I know you're going to be too busy tonight with your stuff and the astronomy, and too busy tomorrow with your posters, but I go into extreme detail what I'm talking about here, what type of black hole is, what types of black holes we have, you know, what's occurring, right? Some nice little math, those of you who like math, and for those of you who want more, I'll introduce in more detail the Schwarzschild metric. I know some of you, one of the groups is just with Chandra is getting into that. But I go into more detail exactly for those of you who are not taking that is what the Schwarzschild metric is, how to use it, how to calculate with it, right? Some nice little examples and using it to solve problems, right? And then I even give you some questions and some answers and some solutions. For those of you who like to follow through this in more detail on your own. So those of you who like the math, back part's got a lot of math, how it works. Those of you who like to understand the verbiage about how it works, the front part has that in more detail that I can possibly go into over the next couple of hours. Okay? So that will be made available to you. All right. Let me see where I put this. First thing I need is this thing. Is there a question already? Yeah. It's a good, strong entry-level book, yes. Yeah, it's called Gravity. Oh, no, this one. No, this is master's level, right? This is where you want to end up, right? And actually, this is not complete anymore. But it's a great, I want to give you an appreciation what you're going to try to understand. And there's no way I can give you this information in 4 hours. But it gives you an appreciation. What I want to try to do is give you an understanding where you sit there and say, wow, I got 4 years of university to learn this. This is going to be a fantastic time. Okay? All righty. If we can suddenly hit the lights over there, I don't know if it make it a bit easier to see. Perfect, thank you. This is the best definition of a black hole I've ever come across. A huge, great, enormous thing like nothing, big, well, like, I don't know, like an enormous, big nothing. That's the best definition, right? So when you write your PhD thesis, right, that should be your title. It all started out in about the late 1700s with a gentleman by the name of Reverend John Mitchell. Now, he is what we call a natural philosopher. That means he's a dude that studies everything, right? So to understand how things work, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're a physicist, you're a philosopher, you're a dentist, a psychologist, a lawyer, you're a bit of everything, right? You really understand this stuff. Now, he was familiar with Newton's rules, Newton's laws. And at that time, people believed light was a particle, right? They bounced off mirrors, and it bounced like a ball bounces off walls. So it was a particle understanding of what light was. And he sat there, and he had this great mind idea that he said that he knows that on the Earth, when you throw up a ball, it comes back down. And he was wondering that if things became more massive, you have to throw things a lot harder. And so he pushed this forward to thinking about something called escape velocity. How fast, how hard do I have to throw something up so it can actually to escape? But he also noticed through Newton's laws that if you keep the mass the same and shrunk down the object, it also had that same property, that it had a larger required escape velocity. And he said, what would happen if nature was able to take something like a star, shrink it down, keep the same mass, but shrink it down enough that the escape velocity was the speed of light? What would you see? And he envisioned this idea that these are little light photons jumping from the surface, but they're coming back down. So he envisioned that if I was over here, I could not see the star because there was no light particle coming off the surface, reaching my eye, and therefore I would not see it. And he called this thing a dark star. The only thing about this dark star that was neat is that you could not see it. There's no rule that says you couldn't go close to the surface and maybe just dip in there with one or two light particles got out of there, but it was a fun mathematical object. And he believed that there could have been a lot, thousands if not millions of these dark stars throughout the universe. But alas, when this dude by the name of Thomas Young came up with the concept of light as a wave, the whole concept of a particle waned, and this whole idea of a dark star faded into oblivion. But it was nice to recognize that. Now let's just show you how simple the math was for this. So how do we calculate the escape velocity? Two simple equations. Hopefully you recognize something to do with form of energy on the one side, and what's on the other side, on the right side? Gravity. Somebody says like, right? Set them equal, right? We plug in some numbers for the Earth, and we could actually rearrange the formula, the equation, and determine that it wouldn't be nice if all math was done this simple. About 11.2 kilometers per second as the escape velocity for Earth, right? That's nice and easy. You probably did something like that in school, right? Nice and simple. Question I have here, what would the Earth's radius be? So I want to take these equations and just rearrange now for the radius. Right? Keep the same mass, the Earth's got the same mass, but now I would like to figure out what would the radius of the Earth be if I tell you I would like the escape velocity to be 3 times 10 to the 8. Now what is 3 times 10 to the 8? Speed of light. So I'm trying to figure out how big would I have to compress the Earth to make it be a dark star. So very easy manipulation. It works out to be approximately about 9 millimeters. Right? And you guys can play with that and play with it. That's how, that's the Earth's radius, like, right? Almost a radius of about a centimeter, right? And that would be Earth as a dark star. Just make a mental note of that number, because that number will appear later on in my talk. Something amazing is going to happen. So, jumping ahead to this dude by the name of Einstein. He was trying to work beyond special relativity, and I'm going to go back a bit to explain special relativity again. But he came up with this concept called the equivalence principle. And he made this conjecture. He said that there is no experiment that you can perform that will distinguish these two diagrams. Now, what are these two diagrams? One of them is somebody sitting on the earth with a nice apple and dropping the apple, and somebody in a box, which is like a rocket ship, which is accelerating upward at 9.8 meters per second squared, the same acceleration as gravity. And he was saying locally, and the word there is very important, that there's no experiment that you can perform that will distinguish these two diagrams. It was with this concept that helped push him along the right track of thinking to allow him to come up with general relativity. So let's just have a look at this nice little animation. So we're going to take our buddy here, Albert. Take a bow. Oh, Albert. Oh no. What's going to happen? You can see that he's actually in a free fall. So you might as well, if you're going to be a free fall, you might as well enjoy it. But it could be that he's in a spaceship that's just sitting there in space. There's no experiment that he could do that could distinguish these two events. Spaceship turns on the rocket engines. It's accelerating at 9.8. And therefore, the bottom of the elevator meets his feet. And for all purposes, right, he would feel the same gravitational field that you would feel here on Earth. And he can do his exercises, which would be equivalent to Albert being on the elevator. So that, in a nice little animation step, it gives it the idea of the equivalence between being in an accelerated frame and being in a accelerated field, gravity. There we are. So this is what Einstein basically says. Okay? He says that gravity is itself manifested as a curvature of space-time, right? And you kind of saw this equation, or versions of this equation, with Mark on the blackboard. Okay, that we're going to go into more detail. I'm going to take you a bit more deeper into these to get you a better feeling about that. But he said Einstein didn't think of gravity as a force between two objects, but as the curving of straight lines. Okay, and it's the mass that is going to cause this curvature. He also shows that some weird stuff is going to happen. Time slows down near curved, very curved objects. So a very massive object will slow down time. So we did a math, and we'll go into more detail. This part here encodes the geometry. This has the curving of space-time. So this specialized matrix mathematical symbol encodes that. And as Mark said, this little T is called the stress energy tensor. This has everything about energy, okay? And everything about energy, not just pressures, but its density, stresses, any component about it, energy in a way that this is equal to this, and we tossed in, he at leisurely tossed in this this cosmological constant that Mark talked about earlier on, right? Now, he didn't necessarily want to do that. Remember when Einstein came up with his theory, right? The astronomers of that day said that the universe was static, right? They said the universe was static, And so he came up with a brand new theory of gravity, but these values were saying that it was dynamical. It was, the universe was enlarging or shrinking and expanding. It was certainly not static. So if the experts told him it was static, he said, well, that's fine. And Mark had mentioned earlier on, we'll just add this component, so this little cosmological constant, to make this match what the current universe was supposed to be doing. Hubble came along, as we know, and when Hubble came along, he basically showed him that, hey, the universe is expanding, all Albert needed to do is remove that little piece, and everybody was happy, and as you probably heard today, we're going to probably slide that piece right back in there, because the universe is accelerating, and so he was right, well, maybe possibly correct all along. Now, equation says many things. Right, you may have heard that the matter itself tells space how to curve, and it's the curving of space that tells matter how to move. So it's quite a beautiful relationship that's taking place in here, and it looks very, very simple, right? Now let's just show you a bit more behind this. It's a coupled elliptic hyperbolic nonlinear partial differential equations for the metric components. We'll just get some definitions of this. Coupled, that means each differential equation contains multiple terms. Equations cannot be solved individually. So elliptic and hyperbolic determinants of submatrices of a system of equation matrix are either positive or negative and never zero. Nonlinear means it's dependent on nonlinear functions of metric components. Partial differential equations, an equation containing partial derivative functions, for example, something ugly like that. And its components of metric tensor G mu u. A lot of people like to say that's like a little u and v, but they ended up being three characters. That's an ugly set of equations. I'm going to show you a partial solution of that. I'm going to show you why general relativity takes a while, because remember, it took Einstein about 12 years, right, with some thinking to come up with it, and he actually produced a couple of versions of it to tweak it. The first one didn't quite work, second one didn't quite work. So to build up to that, let's review space-time. Now, you guys are space-time experts, right, because I've given you space-time questions, and you've had Richard talk about space-time for, at least 9 hours, it seems, right? And you've worked on all those problems, and perfect. So we'll go through this quickly, but it may tie something in for some of you. All righty, let's have a look at space-time diagrams. So, Bob. What? You like it? Cute? Where's that? Oh, there's Alice. And then Alice's twin sister, Alice. Right? I don't know what is Alice Prime, right? All right, so here, very easy, they're 10 meters apart, so I'll call the distance between Alice 10 meters, right? They both synchronize their clocks, right? T equals zero. And Bob goes between Alice and Alice. Right? So both of them would measure that it took about 5 seconds, let's say, to travel the 10 meters, and we could ask questions, how fast was Bob traveling? That's a very easy concept, okay? And the question that Richard would probably make you answer is, how much time has elapsed for Bob? Okay? And that was the whole discovery that we spent at the beginning of last week working our way through. There we go. So let's draw a space-time diagram. Space-time. There we go. Wouldn't it be nice, again, if this just happens on your piece of paper and you can just see it work? Okay, so I got Alice and Alice Prime. Alice Prime is at rest relative to Alice. They are 10 meters apart, and Bob is going to drive between Alice and Alice Prime on this now space-time diagram. So hopefully, in your head, you can superimpose the track that Bob should move across. So there's Bob. G He wants to travel from here to here, but we know he can't do it that way because he also has to travel through time, so he will actually do it that way, right? And then we end up with his world line, right? And you guys are really good at that. And we've got Bob moving relative to Alice. And the question, of course, is I can calculate his velocity, and where do I put his ticks? Now, just to see how well you understand this, and I'll give you some questions that we said, let's draw some space-time diagrams. So we'll go through this really, really quickly. See if you can answer this. How would the space-time diagram look like with Bob at rest relative to Alice? Right, like this, right? Straight up. All righty. And Alice tossing a baseball up. So now it's just trying to pick a frame, which axis do you want? And we always kind of like time to go up. So then you make a decision, how do I want to draw the motion? And you can have a couple of choices, but see if you can see the one I did. How would you draw Bob moving fast? How would you draw Bob moving slow? And how would you draw the Earth orbiting the Sun? And I think you had that question on the thing, because I did that question, I stole it from here too. All right, so Bob at rest relative to Alice. All right, they come, they're standing still, but they're moving through time. So they both would line the straight up. Perfect. Alice tossing a baseball up. And see if you can see the frame that I chose. There's Alice. Alice catching, right? But that's not with time, is it? With time, I chose this axis, and that would be the path. So in a second, here comes catch. You can see how it kind of works out that way. And you hopefully had something very similar in your own diagram. Bob moving fast, Bob moving slow. There we go. And then, what do we have? Finally, Earth orbiting the Sun. So this would look something like this. Earth's trajectory, there'd be the Earth, and there it is, right? Got a nice little gut feel, right? Nice and quick. So let's go back to Bob and Alice. So the question was, how does Bob's clock move? Right. Newton's assumption was you just go horizontal, right? Universal time. Right. So 1 second, 1 second, 2 seconds, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds. But we discovered that wasn't correct. So when Bob moves at different speeds, we discovered that it wasn't like this. There was a time dilation factor that took place. We kind of discovered that our data looks something like this. So slow Bob had a time for 1 second, which was a bit longer than Alice's stationary time, and 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and 4 seconds. But fast Bob's 1 second was like here, and 2 seconds was like that. We discovered that the time was running at a different rate. It wasn't identical. There's no such thing as universal time. And what Einstein tried to do is find an equation that matched the data, right? So the question is, how do we connect the dots? How do we connect all the ones and the twos and the threes and so on? And we should notice something. It kind of like looks like the lines are best eyeballed. They seem to be going up. So the lines that we need to draw seem to bend upwards. It's the only thing that we kind of recognize. Right? The faster Bob goes, the further this one will be, and therefore the line that we come up with somehow bends upwards. That's the only thing that we know. So we need an equation that kind of pulls this thing out. Now, we sit there and say, okay, we've had about maybe 12 years of math at school. There must be something that I can come up with. So we try some ideas. There's our buddy. He's thinking about this, trying to put it together. How do we transfer the circles? That's nonlinear, and there's a bending of circles, right? You sit there and you bend the circles. So if I sat there and I put circles around Alice, maybe this will work. So 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, right? No longer universal, right? Alice's 4 doesn't match Bob's 4. So we look at this very, very carefully and said, well, I know what a circle is. I even know what an equation of a circle is. I can define this very, very easily. If something's on my circle, the equation of a circle, let's say using r squared equals y squared plus x squared, but you may have heard different versions of in school. But in terms of y's and x's, that would be the equation that would match the circle. And you can see that the 4 for Alice is not the same as the 4 for Bob, right? There's a different time. So there was a difference between the two. So we actually have an equation that says, hey, there's no universal time here. But do you notice a problem? Right? We know it's not hard. There's no such thing as universal time, right? Experimental showed us that time dilates. We found an equation that shows that 4 seconds doesn't match 4 seconds. Remember what did it? We said it had to bend up, and this is bending down, right? Circle bends down. So what we really need, right, is a way to take these circles that bend down, right? So you can kind of see, right? It's not four, right? It's bending the wrong way. We want to bend it up. So how do we bend it up? And how do I make a hyperbola? Perfect mathematically? What do I have to do to this wonderful designed equation? Change the plus sign to a, and that gets the question that you were asking before. Why is there a negative sign? There's a negative sign because we need to bend it up like that. And we've used circles, it bends down. So if we change this to that, lo and behold, we get a new set of geometry that matches our data. So we end up with the bending upwards, and that was the equations that you actually derived with Richard earlier on. But that's exactly what we're trying to say. We're saying that it doesn't bend down, it actually bends up the little hyperbolas. And the difference is from the equation of a circle, we popped in this little minus sign, and these guys here become the asymptotes, which ends up representing for us the speed of light. You got it. All right, perfect. We did all special relativity, we're done. Okay. Now, special relativity implies that all matter must move at less than the speed of light. And Richard kind of talked about this, but this is the light cone. So this is the V that we have, and we're just rotating it around. And we have a future, this is the past, and we can only observe things ourselves that interact within the cone, and things that happen outside the cone, for us, are so far away that light won't get to us, so we'll have to see what it looked like literally in the past as we move forward. So, what did Einstein do? So he needed to define a mathematical tool that handled space and time. So I'm writing this in function notation, little p, but now we discovered that time plays just as important a role as space. It's not a separate entity anymore. It's part of the same beast. It's space-time. So its role is identical, so we give it a nice little slot. So I'm going to put it in the first. So I've got T, an X, a Y, and a Z. Okay? With these things, we already know how to handle Cartesian coordinates. And how many people here have had some polar coordinate experience? Okay. Anybody here not had any polar coordinate experience? Okay, so let me just put it in English. It's kind of neat. I can say how far you are away from me, or I can define my distance or your position relative to me two different ways. One way is I could say how far you are in that direction and how far you are in that direction. And the distance is the Pythagorean theorem. Or I can pick a direction, doesn't really matter, and I can say you are a certain distance away from me. So if I say you are 3 meters away from me, you could be 3 meters in any direction. But if I say you're 3 meters away from me, but you're at 10 degrees to my left, that would pinpoint you directly. That's all we're talking about. So basically, an angle and a distance. And now we like polar coordinates because it's easier to work with, right? And so this is like Euclidean. This is with the plus sign, and here is we toss in the minus sign, which is the Minkowski. And it doesn't matter where I put it. I can put it here or here. It depends where I want to, what I want to deal with. And so there's the Minkowski version of the Cartesian coordinates, and the Milne, which is the Minkowski version of the polar coordinates. That's all it is. So it's just that minus sign rather than that plus sign. That's all it means. I'll let you, some people are writing that down, saying, hey, that's a cool looking equation. Okay. And remember, this is in two dimensions, right? I'm just using S and X, or right here. So everybody kind of comfortable with that? I know you've not worked with it, but you're looking and say, okay, I kind of see that notation. It's taking that plus sign, changing it to a minus sign, moving from a circle to a hyperbola. And moving from a circle to hyperbola either in using a Pythagorean type of equation or an equation that turns in distances and terms of angles. Okay? So, geodesic. Okay. So, he somehow, when he came coming up with this concept, a new way of defining gravity, he needed a way to play with Newton's first law. There he is. Okay. And he said a body will move along the curve of shortest distance in space-time unless a force acts on it. And the body will move along the curve of shortest distance in space-time unless a force acts. It's almost identical to Newton's first law, right? Except what word did I put on it? And I emphasize it to let you know that we have to be careful here. Oh, yeah, you guys are so smart. Space-time, right? Perfect. Now, interesting stuff is the shortest distance between two points in general space isn't naturally a straight line that you think of. Right? And this distance that we call the shortest is called a geodesic. So you'll hear about pilots using this, right? You'll hear about people dealing with geometry using, I need to draw a geodesic. I need to draw the shortest distance between two points. Let me illustrate that this way. Here we are. I want to take a flight from Canada to Rome. And the plane wants to do it in the shortest distance. And the shortest distance is actually this nice little curve across the surface. Okay? Doesn't need to change the plane. He's just keeping it, flying it straight. And the path or the trajectory is this wonderful geodesic. That is what we mean. Right? That's the natural curve that this plane is going to follow. In general relativity, everything we talk about, all we're interested in is the shortest distance between two points. Now, the problem is they're difficult to calculate in general, right? Imagine trying to look at this surveying map over there, and we're trying to come out and figure out the shortest distance of two points, and we have a lot of hills and valleys. Is it faster to go over, or maybe to go around the one side of the mountain, back down this valley? I need the shortest distance to get between point A and point B. And Einstein had to figure this thing out, not with a hill and a valley. He had to do it in literally four dimensions, because time is incorporated in this thing. He needed to figure this thing out. Right? Now, it would be very easy, right, if you looked at the point, the landscape from above, and just looked down and said, hey, okay, I'm in an airplane. I see the two points. I look down. Well, there they are right there. I don't really see any hills and any valleys from above. And if it's from above, it looks like I can just apply the Pythagorean equation. Okay? But he has to do this in space. So he needs a way to transform those hills and valleys mathematically to correspond to the concept of looking down at and saying, oh, that's very, very easy. So you kind of get a feeling of how what he's going to try to come up with. Okay? So he needs to use a mathematical quantity that converts the flat map distances into actual distances on a curved space. Okay? And this is what he defines as our metric, which we'll denote by G. So we're going to create a new mathematical tool to do all this transformations for us. Okay? So just a way of transforming the looking down perspective into the actual distance traveled by going up and down the valley, maybe around this mountain on the left and around that mountain on the right. Okay? Now this metric is going to change depending upon the geometry and how many hills and valleys you are. So the metric has to be dynamic, it has to be able to handle any situation. All right. Now, the concept of a metric is very, very easy, but some of you heard it for the first time. It's a way of converting universal distances to distances on curves. It's a way of going back and forth. And the best way is, if you think about it, it's like a taxi meter, which converts fixed amounts of time and distance into a cost function for a customer. So that would be like a mechanical metric, right? You plug in what time of the day it is, how far you're going, and the taxi device will actually calculate how much it's going to cost when you get there, right? Now, the nice thing about the metric of the taxi cab is you can change it. It depends upon the time, but it can also depend on the location as well. For example, if you're going to take a taxi in New York City to travel a certain distance, I will probably guarantee it's more expensive than it is to take a taxi in Waterloo to travel the same distance. If it's raining outside, it may be more expensive, right, to travel. At nighttime, they may have the ability to change the pricing. Right? So the metric keeps track of all of these things and does the conversion for you. So mathematically, that's what we want to do. Now, it's not a single number at each point. And the reason for that is we're talking about curvature, right? We're trying to figure out how the things curve. Okay? Now, we talked about two types of curvature that you're going to have to encounter. Curvature, let's say, on a cylinder versus a curvature on a sphere. So on a sphere, hopefully you recognize that it curves in two directions. It curves east and west, and it also curves north and south. How do you know it curves? If you take your buddy Albert Einstein and you have him walk around, after a large period of time, he will come back to where he started from. Make sense? So we know he knows it's a curvature. Okay? This is also a curvature. But you kind of notice that it only bends in one direction. In this case, it bends east and west. And we know it's a curvature because, again, somebody could walk here and walk around and come back exactly where they ended. So we know we've got a curvature, but there's something different about these two types of curvatures. Okay. Now, for these two geometries, we're going to need two numbers to somehow specify the type of curvature. Right? This one curves in two ways, this one curves in one way, so we need a couple of variables to keep track of how things curve. Now, in four dimensions, right, we're going to need a couple of more numbers, right? So we're going to represent two numbers to show the matches with gxx and gyy to show that they associated with the curvature in the x and y direction, right? So it looked pretty good for the little thing I put you on the screen, but in four dimensions, it works out to keep track of the curvatures because we've got time, you've got time in the x and time in the y and x and y, and you've got all these different combinations. We need 10. Right, 10 variables that we want to deal with. Okay, now all of a sudden, rather than two numbers to keep track of the different types of curvature, remember we're talking about curvature space and time, I now need 10 numbers to keep track of how these things are curving with respect to each other. So I get a good map. So the topological map is getting more and more complex. Once you get more and more complex, you need another tool just to keep track of the complexity. Right? So I need another mathematical tool to keep these numbers straight, yet allow me to do the calculations, because the bottom line is I want to figure out what's the shortest path between A and B. And what is this type of a tool? You may have heard of it. This is the tensor. Okay? Al, tell us about the tensor. All right. It's telling us that they're simple, organized groups of numbers. They have an index that tells how big they are. That is how many numbers they hold. For example, a zero tensor, I know it was a zero tensor and holds one number, weird. But yes, the zero tensor has a single number, that's all it holds, a single element. Right? A one tensor can, in this case for space-time, so we'll just talk about space-time, it will hold an element for the t, the x, the y, and the z, right? So it has a string of four numbers, a time, x position, a y position, a z position, right? So four values. And a two tensor is a matrix, right, of 4 by 4. So there's a t on the x, t on the y, x on x, y. And so we end up coming out with a matrix. So some of you have had some experience with matrix. You've actually had you're talking about a subset of a tensor, so you're actually starting to become familiar with a tensor. It's a container that holds things. That's all it is. So since we're going to be dealing with general relativity, and it's a three space plus one with time, we'll be using this little beastie here, a 4 by 4 matrix tensor to keep track of all the other 10 things that we have to plug in. So this, all this guy's going to do is just, it's going to have little placeholders, put those 10 things in. That's all we're doing. There we go. So with these tools, I can finally write down the geometry of space-time and how it's affected by mass, how it's affected by the geometry of space-time, how mass affects the geometry, and how geometry affects the movement of the mass. So there is the full beast. Now, G and C, they're constants, right? Speed of light is a constant, G is constant. A lot of us will take that and make it one, and a lot of books you'll read it as G equals 8 pi T, and then I've tossed in the cosmological constant in there because I figured, what the heck, he spent some time figuring it out, I might as well leave it in there. So this is what we've got. So we've got Einstein's tensor, which is really itself based upon another tensor called the Ricci tensor, which has a little G metric, and it has a Ricci scalar, and there's a nice little half. So this tensor is actually made up of another tensor, but we don't have to worry about it. These are slots. We take all these dudes, right, that define how it's curved. So we need the mathematics to define how things are curving, and these guys just go into these equations, or these things go right inside here. Those are all constants. There is the tensor that deals with stress and the energy. You have, remember Mark was talking before? There's the density parameter, this little blue dude right there. And there's the three, he talked about three pressures, right? You know, I think he had that, he had the rho equals plus three pressures. Rho plus three pressures. There it is right there. There's, that's the thing he was kind of talking about, right? That deals with this. And this is all the energy, this is all the energy that deals with momentum and stress, all the momentum of space we're trying to talk about, right? And this is how this thing is manifested as the curving, as the geometry of this thing. And then, like I said, just for fun, here's the other tensor that deals with the cosmological constant inside there, right? So this is Einstein. If you heard about Einstein's field equations, that is Einstein's field equations, right? It's a tensor equation relating a set of symmetrical 4x4 tensors, literally given by, so given by the, now we have 16 equations in this form, but we really have to worry about 10, so it'd be nice to deal with. But we're trying to solve these things. Remember, we're trying to find a solution. There's an equal sign. What values make it? But all of these guys could have equations inside that, calculating stresses and energies and curvatures and geometries. Somehow we have to solve all of this simultaneously. So, if I sat down and wrote the Ricci tension, that was the guy just on this side, for a two-dimensional space, and I'll give it a symmetry to make it even nicer, this is what it would look like. This is a two-dimension. Just imagine trying to do this with all the things. Okay? We cannot solve it. Supercomputers cannot solve it. Einstein couldn't solve it. Nobody can solve it. We can take restricted components. We can look at very simplified regions and make some nice simple adjustments and sit there and say, well, look at this situation, the billiard ball version of gravity. Now you can see I didn't write it. I made the computer kick this thing out. Right? But you know what? Every one of you, and I'll just get there and I'll answer the question and then I think it's time for a break. Everybody in your life, when you take general relativity, you will experience the pain and suffering of trying to solve a simple problem. And then you'll say, Bill Gates, thank you, thank you, thank you. Steve Wozniak, Steve Jobs, thank you, just those Mac people, thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, perfect. Question?
Has anyone looked into using a quantum computer to approach this sort of problem?
We don't even know how to. When we talked about the great question, how do I prepare the seeds? And I said, yes. The ability fact, we're trying to figure out how to even write a language to even put forward a question to make it fact or something, let alone figure this thing out. If we can come up with something like that, I don't know how you would encode this, but you know what? It would look at all the possible scenarios and give a probability and say the two dudes, the five dudes, the 12 dudes at the highest peaks are most likely the right answer, and it could probably do it. So it's me. So you've got, let's say, 4 years, 2 years, in 7 years, well, you should be able to figure this thing out. Okay, so I'll wait for your PhD paper. Right? There we go. And boy, I can see why it took Einstein about 12 years to figure this dude out. Right? So, but what does it say? This is what it says graphically. If I've got an object that has mass, its mass, i.e. its energy, bends and creates a curvature. This curvature is the path which things follow. So I've got this ball, it's just following a straight line. It follows a straight line, it knows nothing of the curvature, it's just going in a straight line. That straight line happens to be curved, and so it follows that natural geodesic. And that's what sets itself up to model gravity. That's what Einstein's equations say. Gravity is a manifestation of the natural shortest distance between two points, which is really a curvature. Okay? We see that one again, just to, just so you can get a feeling of it. Let's run that again. It should, there we go. So, a mass is going to bend. Now, you know, this is representation, right? So a mass, i.e. the Earth, the Sun, bends space-time, bends it, makes a curve. Another mass going on a straight line, it just follows the straight line. And it happens to be that straight line happens to be curved. It knows nothing of the curve. It just follows a straight line. Right? And you can see how this emulates or duplicates Newton's laws of gravity. And that's what his field equations are trying to do. Question? You could probably do that with a lot more math, but it's a bit more complicated, mainly because you've got positives and negatives. Right here, we're dealing with only one. That's kind of easy, right? And there's a lot more complicated reasons why you don't want to do that, and it may not even be possible. But here, the nice thing about gravity, it is one direction. That makes it nice and easy. Okay. To try to do it with other forces, you'd have to figure out how to rewrite those things. So that wouldn't be fun. What I've got here, this was done, and I believe it was an HP computer. This is just a Newton's calculations. It's a hypothetical situation. I've got a large mass, very large mass, and this large mass has enough gravitational force that it's pulling up a chunk of water. So this ball is floating in some water. Some dude put a table and a ball and this pink thing and looks like a lollipop on a table. I don't know why they did these things, but they came up with this calculation. All this was rendered using Newton's laws. So Newton's laws with a huge mass. Can you imagine how strong this mass would be to lift up water off the lake towards it? Okay, those are using Newton's calculations. And I believe it was an hour's worth of number crunching way back when. I'm going to show you the same situation. And I think this one took about a week or so of number crunching on the computer to run through its best, because these are all hypothetical objects, right? They're not spinning, so they got, right? They got masses and things like that. So the equations are a bit easy to work with. But what would the visualization look like if I use general relativity and this is a large mass? Because it's large mass, enough of a mass to lift up the water. And this is what it looks like. And so this is what general relativity would say that you would actually visually see. In fact, it looks like you're looking through that purple bar thing, right? Right? The building over there is now appearing. It's almost acting like a lens, isn't it? Distorting. Let's only go back one, just to see if I show you. Right? This is the ball. It's like a checkered ball. All you can see is like this portion of the top. Look what happens to the geometry, the bending that takes place. And there's a nice little picture opportunity. Yes, in front of the pink object, because this is Newton's laws. This is Newton's laws, right? But when we apply the laws of general relativity, light is now going to be bent. It's following the straight line, but it's curving around the object. We're actually seeing the back end of the ball. Light in the back, it's actually been curved and would normally go behind, but now it's coming forward. Right? So all of a sudden, if we start using Einstein's equations for large objects, things get strange, right? Now, could you imagine being Einstein coming up with your new modified version of Newton's laws of gravity and saying, by the way, you need to understand four more years of math because I created and other people created and put this math together to come up with, and this is what you have to try to solve just to come up with these predictions, and when you use these predictions, you get this strange thing. Time moves at different rates, visual effects occur, bending of space, right? It would be a hard sell, right? And it had to wait until 1919, right, when one of his believers, and we're going to hear about this guy before, this is Sir Arthur Eddington, and this took place just after, I think it was World War, so that this would be World War I, I believe. It would be. It would just be the end, so there would be still some skirmishes taking place. So He didn't want to, the story goes that Eddington did not want to fight in a war. He was like a conscientious objector. So he sat there and he said to the British government that, don't send me to the war, right? What I will do is I want to do an experiment based on this young German patent clerk named Albert Einstein to see if we've got a better way of understanding gravity. Because if you understand gravity better, we can build better weapons. You know, so he's to sell things to the government, right? And so that got him this job. Now the problem is, one of the, you saw from the picture, the beautiful, beautiful picture, that one of the things that it does, it bends light. Right? We actually saw it bending light. So according to Einstein's equations, it says if you have a large enough mass, it will bend light. And they said, well, what's the most massive thing that we least know about that we can at least interact with? That's the sun. And I said, okay. With the sun, that's no problem, because with the sun, what should occur, right, is that there's the Earth orbiting the sun, but light will follow a curved path. So as I fill out the curved path, I get rid of the sun, the actual object's position matches where I think it, I should see it. So without the sun, that's where the star should be aligned. Okay? So if the sun is in the way, the light will actually curve, and I will think I'm seeing it over here. Okay? Like a, that's a little gravitational lens. So Einstein and kind of figured out. Now, Einstein had to do a couple of tweaks with the equations and do the calculations more than once. He was good at math, maybe not so good at arithmetic. But he did the calculations and double-checked again, which is good because the first time they were going to do it, his numbers were wrong, and then he bugged it. He didn't have calculators back then, so he had to do it the longhand way. So Eddington said, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I'll look at a star or set of stars in the sky at nighttime. I know exactly where the position is. Dot, 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 dot. He says, okay, I want the sun to get in the way. Because the sun, when the sun's in the way, it's going to bend the light path, and the stars will deviate a bit. And the only time I can do that, the problem is in the daytime, it's too bright to see the stars. So he waited for a solar eclipse. So, smart dude. Yeah, not only does he not get to war, he gets a cruise Principe, just off the Africa's Gulf of Guinea, right about here. He sat there and said, okay, I'm going to take a picture. And I know, because our astronomers took a picture earlier on when there was no sun in the way and it was nighttime, I know where the stars should be. And if Einstein was right, there should be a shift. The bending, and that is actually, this is actually one of the pictures, right? And that you can see where it should be, and there's the bending that took place. It's off enough. Now, a lot of fun games are doing here. Not all pictures showed this, so if you go on a cruise paid by the government, you only show the pictures that work, right? And so, but he was convinced enough and happy enough, and it was okay. I think I got a note put on here. It says, this is actually from Eddington. It says, about 1:30, when the partial phase was well advanced, we began to get glimpses of the sun. Imagine doing that and it was cloudy, right? At 1:55, we could see the crescent through the cloud almost continuously and large patches of clear sky appearing. We had to carry out our program photographs in faith. I did not see the eclipse, being too busy changing plates. It wasn't Mr. Digital Camera. It was cameras with glass plates. Just like the ones we did for the holographic. These are big glass plates. That's how your cameras looked like back then, right? Except for one glass to make sure it had begun. We took 16 photographs, but the cloud had interfered very much with this story. So it was a lot. Doing all this, and you had to rely on it. Didn't have the weather forecast that we have over nowadays. So it was quite a quite a, team, an accomplishment. He actually had a team of people doing it, and you can see the poster that they did afterwards to emphasize what was taking place, right? After it was done, there was a telegram that came, left the offices basically saying that Newton said there shouldn't be that, Einstein's equation said there should be that, the photograph showed there was it, therefore Einstein was correct. It literally made Einstein a very famous person the next day. It hit all the presses, all the newspapers the next day. There we go, get rid of that. Perfect. There we go. Now, we've done a better test of relativity. One took place in 1976. This happened when we actually placed spacecraft on Mars. And at a certain time during the year, we actually had the Earth and Mars aligned with the Sun in the line of sight. And so with the Sun in the line of sight, it should warp the path of the signal coming from Mars to Earth. And therefore, if there's a warping or a stretching or a change of the path, it would take a bit longer for the light signals to get from Earth to Mars. And as you can see, the animation is showing you the excess time delay in microseconds and the corresponding distance that corresponds to when it was really close. So that was probably the best verification. And as we've talked before, it's probably one of the most verified set of equations that we have. We talked about GPS, that whole, how it would not work and it collapses very, very quickly, about special and general relativity, both combined. So yeah, it's certainly a non-intuitive. We don't like it. It goes against our intuition, right? Because it says time goes at a different rate. Distances are changing depending on the gravitational mass, the way that we measure a distance, the paths that are followed. So it came out with this beautiful equation, right? We've tested it, right? Scientists didn't want to believe it, but had no choice. But it did explain another phenomena that was causing many headaches, and this was the precessing of Mercury's axis. We've known this for a long time, that we've recorded Mercury because it's one of the easiest planets to record. You need good sunglasses so you don't go blind. But it was out by 43 arc seconds per 100 years. Doesn't sound like much, but it was something. It didn't match the Newton's laws, right? And so that's one of the first things Albert did when he, with his equations, he was able to at least verify this. And so he was very ecstatic himself that this matched out before anybody else could do any other theoretical verifications. So what to do with the field equations? All right. 1916. So this is about a year after Einstein produced it. The gentleman Carl Schwarzschild, he came up with the billiard ball solution of the equations, right? Remember how complicated they are? So he chose a billiard ball solution. So he's going to sit there and take an object with mass. He's going to make the object a perfect sphere. He's not going to give it anything fancy. He's not going to rotate, not going to move. It's just going to be a sphere just sitting there. Right, everything, a lot of zeros and all those other in that matrix. Okay, and then he came up with what would happen to another billiard ball placed close to that sphere. That's what he's trying to do. What is happening between two very simple objects? So he did this while on the front during World War One. There was no internet. They mailed these things the slow way. So he mailed the solution to Einstein and had Einstein present it to the Academy of Sciences. And then about 4 months later, he died on the front. I think it was due to illness of what happened with the ugliness of war during World War One. But what did he come up with? He came up with this nice little equation. Now, if you look at it, don't be scared of it right away. Just look at this and say, hey, you know what? This kind of looks like something that I've seen before. I've got something that's a negative, something that's plus, got angles. Now, we've moved from two dimensions to three dimensions. So I've got two angles now. How much something's rotated this way and rotated this way. I've got something that deals with positions and times. And you can see I'm kind of using in polar coordinates. So this, and I think there's a group here that's working on probably a simplified version of this called the Schwarzschild metric, right? So you, some of you are working on that. And I've, for those of you who are not, I've given you a full detailed explanation in the notes how this thing is derived and how to use it to solve problems. Okay? So this is the first solution. Right? And one of the things you may notice is that you've got different parameters here, right? We've got an RS and an R, another RS and an R, right? RS is equal to this funny little constant thing over here dealing with the mass of an object, Newton's G, a 2, speed of light squared. The part that you should be very interested in is when we come up with an equation, we like to know when the equation bites the big one. In other words, where does the equation divide by zero? Under what circumstances can we make the equation divide by zero? Because something weird happens there. So looking at that, and assuming that you can R is like, think of R as I don't get too technical, but think of R as measuring a special type of radius. So you're coming in to the center. When does something weird happen? R is equal to zero. If R equals zero right away, you divide by zero. You divide by zero on this dude, you divide by zero on this dude. That's an ugly divide by zero. Both of them divide by zero, right? You can't divide by zero. So when R goes to zero, you divide by zero. Everybody see that? Okay. When else can there's something weird happen? Oh, look at this. An R is equal to RS. Then I get 1 minus 1, which is 0, and they're dividing that, just that term by 0. Wow. This is neat. And so that tells me that in this equation, there are two locations for R where ugly stuff happens. One when you get to this RS, one when you get to this 0. Now, this was just representing the simplest way of talking about gravity and figuring out things out. But this gives us some interesting stuff. It says that if I get to this location where R equals RS, I will temporarily divide by zero ugliness, right? But then R can still go smaller. Then I'm back into numbers again, which is fine. It's just that one location. But when I get to zero, everywhere it's starting to explode. This is going to help us understand, right? Looking at the equation, this is the equation that kind of leads to us the concept of a black hole. Right? When you get to a certain distance, you divide by zero. This will be something which we're going to call the event horizon. And when you get to someplace else with zero, this is going to be the singularity. So you're seeing mathematically a story being told. This is, and inside here you've got DRs, DTs, and your angles and stuff like that. Angles just means which direction you're approaching. So if we just approach from one direction, we just make our thetas, make all these guys equal to zero, which is fine. We got a story about what's happening. And that's what I'm going to let you play with in the notes. I'm going to allow you to see what happens when you're the guy doing the falling in, right? What happens to what? How do you measure your time? What do you get as a DT, change in time? Or what happens from somebody sitting outside watching you pass by them? Or what I call the big kahuna dude. He's the guy that just watches everything and then just brings in all the data and just kind of puts it all together and gets a big picture. So those of you who did the falling, I think you probably called it the rain. The range, right, so which is, it's just different perspectives. Who's looking at what? Perfect. All right. So I'm just putting these guys into that little G just to give you a feeling. Remember, just every now and then I'll toss this thing in just so you get an idea. Oh, this is popping into here. So these are the guys that go in here, and this guy pulls out this guy. Hey, that's pretty easy. This metric This tensor technique of using placeholders allows me to represent something, an equation, in a matrix format. And if I know how to solve matrix, it's very easy to solve these things. So that's something that you're going to learn how to do. Right? Okay. I'll let people write that one down. Yes? Oh, that's probably my S. You may have used an S, right? DS, I don't know, but it's just a symbol, right? I'm using the position, right? There's two sets of equations. There's a space version and a time version. I think I'll show you, I think next slide shows the both of them. It's just whatever symbol I felt like using at the time. Okay. So I'm just going to show you. You see how, this is kind of neat. You see how we can use this to represent that. I give a worksheet on vectors and matrices, right near the beginning in the math part, or just to play with. Have a look at that, because you'll see the equation. And I get this guy here. This metric would have different things in there depending what kind of metric you use. But the equation using this guy is going to be identical. So you'll see the same equation, but each guy will have a different version of G. And that depends on the different types of things that you're trying to describe. And that allows us to be lazy, because we just love to be lazy. All right, perfect. So yeah, there it is. There's the time version and space version. So you, right, proper time versus proper distance. Yeah, some people use S's and T's, or S primes, T primes, whatever, right? So gives you a snapshot. Now you're going to get a copy of the, it's all explained in the notes, so you don't have to worry about trying to write all this thing down. There's a lot of stuff inside there. But I'm just going to show you, this is the first solution. This is called the Schwarzschild metric, right? The billiard ball solution to Einstein's field equations. Right? And even though it looks kind of scary, if you recognize it, all I've got is a curvature parameter, I got something dealing with time, something dealing with position, and something that tells which angle I'm going into. Right? This is, am I approaching the circle, the sphere, at what degree angle and what, you know, what altitude, what RA, what depth? So if I approach it at 0, 0, 0, I usually make these guys equal to 0, and it's even a shorter equation. But it's, notice how there's a positive and a minus sign, or a minus and a positive, that plus minus rather than everything being plus. So that follows that. Now, if I plug in that equation, just remember, this is that distance, that Schwarzschild radius that I was talking about. That's how close you are to where I first divide by 0 when R equals RS. That's the first time I, right, that event horizon location. So I sit there and said, okay, what happens if I plug different values? Now that's a constant, that's a 2, that's a constant. C we know is a constant. M is the mass of my object. So what happens if I put in different values of M? So just for fun, I put in, I got an atom, I've got a nice, well-rounded individual, tossed in the Earth, tossed in the Sun, tossed in a galaxy, and if the universe was closed, a good guesstimate of that. And this will tell me what is that radius, that distance where all of a sudden I divide by 0, the event horizon. And the atom, not too exciting. Human being, not too exciting. But look at this number here, 0.89. When did you hear that 0.89? Yeah, which is right? I think we had that Mitchell producing dark stars to the Earth. What happens? Out pop. A very similar thing. Now, the numbers are the same, which makes you feel really good, but the geometry is different. Each one explained a different way. Here it says, hey, this is something cool. I'm dividing by 0, but if I get closer, something weirder is going to happen because I get all this curvature happening. Whereas Mitchell says with a dark star, yeah, you just can't see it because the pool of photons can't get off. But you can still go down, and as long as you've got a big enough rocket, you can dip in and visit and call and leave and all sorts of stuff. That only when you get to the surface area that you're having problems. So this creates different objects, these different radii where weird, wonderful stuff happens, right? Mathematically, you kind of, you've seen these kind of embedding diagrams that we use to represent this. Because it's hard to visualize the math. So we try to visualize it using wonderful graphics. The problem with graphics is they're only, what I've got here is a three-dimensional representation, a three-dimensional representation of a four-dimensional event happening on a two-dimensional screen. Right? Well, the screen's only two dimensions. I'm trying to warp something in four dimensions, but I can only show three dimensions. Right? And therefore, I create this embedding diagram. So you have to kind of visualize. This is what gravity would be kind of manifested as, this embedding diagram. So this is, you've probably seen those things where you put money in for, and your coin rolls down the well, and you watch it, right? So that's that type of scenario right there. You can have to imagine that this funnel is simultaneously at every direction in a sphere, because everything is pulled toward it at every angle, right? So I think it's a good spatial representation about what's happening. So it's nothing about time, but it certainly gives you a feeling of what's happening from a spatial perspective. There are other physicists who hate these diagrams altogether, but I think it's useful. It gives you a gut feel, and you have to understand that we're just looking at it from a spatial perspective, from a one-plane spatial perspective. All right. So I'm going to take you a bit on a history, a bit more now, and I'm going to introduce some characters. Now, these characters are going to play a very important role. Now, the first character, which you've already met, this is Sir Arthur Eddington. Now, he produced, in 1926, the book called The Internal Constitution of the Stars. He was Mr. Star. He was the star man of that time, right? You know you're important when you're a sir. So his expertise, his knowledge, something about his personality, but he is a very important, he's the Stephen Hawking of the time. So if I'm talking here and Stephen just went rolling by that door over here, you guys would be out of here so fast, right? Right? All right? Yeah. Even if I was giving you ice creams, you'd still be out of there, right? There's no bribing happening. He was the same type of dude back then, right? Albert was just making his way on the scene. He was one of the few people, I'm not sure, but I think it was him that said that somebody asked him, or said that there were three people on the planet that understood Einstein's general theory of relativity, and Sir Arthur Eddington said, well, who's the other one? Right, yeah, so he had, that's the type of personality. So he tested it, and then whatever his data said, people believed, right? Even though there may have been some fudging happening over there, but he was trying to solve a mathematical mystery, because he was the guy that understood how stars lived and died, right? A star, one of those objects we see at nighttime, they go through a process. And so he believed that all stars, every star, ends up becoming something called a white dwarf or a rock star. That means it burns up its fuel, its mass pulls it together, and it just sits there and just kind of glows without burning any more fuel. And after a while, it radiates all its heat, and it just becomes a rock. Right? He believed that every star of every size literally had this process. There was a problem with it. It was a kind of a paradox, because when a star radiates heat, it would actually try to contract. But he wanted the star to be stable, so somehow he had it contracting to radiate heat, and then somehow locking itself back into position again to be stable, but then somehow it radiated more heat. It would contract a bit, but somehow lock it back itself bigger again. There's a bit of a paradox that he couldn't quite figure out. There was something not quite right, but it was something small, and he was Sir Arthur Eddington, and nobody's going to test it too much. So here's our first player. Then my other character is Chandrasekhar. And I can never pronounce the first name, and I won't even try. If somebody's brave, wants to take a shot. It's music. Say that again. Say that again. Oh. Yeah. I'm going to call him Chandra for sure. All right. Now, Chandra was relatively young. I think the idea about 16, 17 years old, 19 maybe, and that's relatively young. He was going to university to study under him, and he was on a boat by him basically making his way back then to study under his idol. Now, he had a copy of Eddington's book. And he actually, on the boat ride, figured a way of how to resolve it. Right? At least the idea, the approach to solve it. Now, he got an opportunity to work with Eddington. So his dream came true. He actually got to work with Eddington. And Eddington, because he was a sir, back then had the first type of computer, nothing like what you would think about. This is a computer made of dials. You push levers and downs and things like this, and you keep doing this, and you pull a crank and leave it, it would actually rotate dials and would do calculations. Okay? But Sir Arthur Eddington had one of these things, and because Chandra was a student under Eddington, he had an opportunity to work on that because he wanted to help his idol resolve the paradox of this white wolf. And he actually figured out, like I said, he had the concepts, he worked out the math, and it was a beautiful solution. His solution incorporated relativity with a bit of quantum. And with that, he was able to resolve the paradox by showing that not all stars die as a white dwarf. That in fact, there was a maximum size that was allowed. Now, he worked on this paper, and Eddington, the story goes that Eddington was watching what he was doing, and Chandra got invited to the Astronomical Society, not this one, another one, to present his solution, and Chandra thought it was amazing because he figured out how to resolve the paradox, but it also showed that Eddington was right up to a point, then something else had to happen. Now, he goes and does his presentation. Could you imagine how nervous you are? Young man, just come up with this stuff. You're incorporating materials that very few people really understand. And in a way, you're going to be showing that your boss is kind of wrong at a certain point. But he was invited, and he was so excited. He goes. He does his presentation and expects, the applause, slaps on the back, the accolades that would go with this. But then after he was done, the arbitrator said, okay, now we're going to have a rebuttal to this by Sir Arthur Eddington. Now, Sir Arthur Eddington had already seen all the work and knew where not all the I's were dotted and all the T's were crossed because it was the first presentation of paper, and you need to figure everything out. And there were certain things that didn't quite make a bit of sense, needed tweaking a bit. But Eddington knew where things were right and where things were wrong. And we rebutted basically whatever Chandra said. And you could imagine how you'd feel. Your own idol kind of dishes you in front of peers that you're trying to make all the other scientists kind of felt sorry for him. Right? They know what was happening. Now, the scientists had a chance to go over that, and even after time, they kind of knew that Chandra was right, but nobody would come out and say it in public yet. Right? There was needed a lot more evidence. Now, Chandra actually left. This working on this white dwarfs for many, many years, probably looks like close to 20, 25 years, and then got back involved with black holes. But he did receive, as you can see, the Nobel Prize for his work, right? And I believe he died sometime in the 1990s. So it's not too long ago that he was still around. And yes, you've made some good when you get a telescope named after you. And so some of you know about the Chandra images and the X-ray telescope. So we've got Chandra putting his two cents. So that's two characters that played a nice role. There we go. Oh, Walter and Fritz. All right. This character here, it'd be the guy that you would never want as your physics professor, right? He would look at you and say, you're a bag of water. You're wasting space, right? You know, he didn't have the best personality in the world. But what they did was they worked within the field of understanding supernova, which is very important. So we're trying to put together a history. So we have, if you think about it, using the field of general relativity, you had Chandra figuring out what a white dwarf is, type of star, figuring out how it lives, what it requires to die. Then we have, again, we're still in the 30s. We have these guys basically talking about the next step, white dwarf, and they said that after white dwarf, a certain size, they're going to have another star, which is going to be called a neutron star. So these guys predicted the neutron star as the next step to Chandra's star. And it wasn't observed or verified until almost 1968. They got the process, but they were missing a link. So they spent a lot of time recognizing these type of supernova, and somehow from these supernova became a neutron star. And they weren't quite sure of the process, but they knew it had a role, and there was this type of star beyond the step of the white dwarf. Another dude. Oppenheimer. Now, when you think of Oppenheimer, what do you think of? Yeah, and that's not what his work was. He was a black hole physicist, cosmologist, right? He just, because he was one of the best to understand how stars work, it became natural for the government to request that he worked on this project, and he got involved with that, even though he didn't really believe it at the end, and then got banished from the program and got ridiculed and actually had nervous breakdowns. He had a kind of a rough life because of that. But from our perspective, he actually showed us something else. He says, okay, I've got Chandra talking about these little white dwarfy things. I've got Zwicky talking about these little neutron stars. And he said that there's, again, we're building upon the Schwarzschild metric and adding more to it, understanding it. He says, well, look, I've got this next step, this thing which we now call a black hole, but they did not call a black hole back then, right? The most common name was called a frozen star. And one of the reasons it's called a frozen star, if you can remember the Schwarzschild metric, for the first one we divide by zero. As you divide by zero, the time component also went to zero. And so time seems to stop. And that's right. So that's why we call a frozen star. Things would seem to freeze in time when they got to that event horizon, right? And he said basically a larger star could form a black hole. So you had a neutron star, and you go up a notch or two, and you got yourself a larger frozen star, or whatever you wanted to call it. He used all the, back then there's a lot of calculations in doing this. So if you can imagine, if you had to do a lot of calculations on stellar dynamics, not very many universities have $1 billion computers running around, but the government did. And so to understand how to build the bomb, you had to understand how the sun worked, because you're trying to duplicate how the sun works. And so he was able to use that to help put together, solve some problems, so he could actually figure out how, from an astrophysics point of view, how the process works. He had a major battle with this concept of this object, with Wheeler. Wheeler, and I'm just gonna show you, this is how close it, yeah, this is the same Wheeler I'm talking about. Wheeler, right? Same Wheeler, right? Wheeler to- totally did not believe this, and in fact insulted Oppenheimer. And Wheeler, you're going to find out that he recognized he was wrong. Wheeler says, oops, you know what? I'm studying this thing, and I was wrong. Black holes are these objects. Wheeler's the one who coined the phrase black hole. Right? He said these things really do mathematically exist. Doesn't mean they physically exist. They said at least mathematically, based on what we're following, these things do exist. And Wheeler tried to apologize, but the animosity between the two was enough that Oppenheimer did not reciprocate and actually felt was very, very rejected. And I think, Mark, you may know one or two good stories about Oppenheimer.
Yeah. The Levi blacklisted on the McCarthy skit because he refused to build a bigger bomb. And so because he refused that, we didn't want to get my
head. Can you imagine that one of the best scientists in the world figured these things out, actually helped stop the war, depending on your philosophy, right? So he stopped the war. And then because he refused to do bigger and better bombs, his career was over. And it affected him psychologically.
Interesting, too, the father of the A-bomb in Russia was also blacklisted.
Yeah, Zelzevich. Yeah. So we'll encounter Zelzevich in a second. All right. Oh, Oppenheimer also had a run-in with this dude. Right? So in 1939, Einstein wrote a paper about his concerns about Oppenheimer's paper and the Schwarzschild radius. In states, the Schwarzschild singularities do not exist in physical reality. He demonstrated that the collapsing star is unstable when it reaches the Schwarzschild radius, which ended up being mute since the star collapses in the singularity there anyway. Einstein did not believe in what the Schwarzschild equation said. He did not believe in black holes. No way can this thing create this object. Oppenheimer said yes. Einstein said no. So and Oppenheimer produces a paper. Einstein produces a paper to refute, and ends up being that Einstein was shown to be wrong by making the wrong assumption. That happens sometimes. Your ego gets in the way. Einstein's paper was shown to be wrong. Oppenheimer was feeling he's feeling happy about that. But imagine this: even the guy who creates the theory didn't believe in what you come up with. Meanwhile, Soviet counterpart, Yakov Zeldovich, great name, right, he's known for many things, but he developed the theory of nuclear chain reactions and how stars work from Russia. He led the USSR atomic bomb, so there's quite a few parallels between the two. Okay. He created a black hole research team in 1962, so he went into black hole research as well, but he wasn't perfect. He thought that supermassive black holes powered quasars, so he's pretty good there. But he also thought that a lot of volcanoes got their magma and the energy from little atomic explosions taking place underneath the Earth. Right, so he wasn't perfect, but he was the Soviet counterpart to Oppenheimer. There was another trying to remember the Lev, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the last name, but there's another Landau. I'll have to double check the name. He was another Russian scientists who also believed that all stars, including the sun, actually had a, I think it was Landau, yeah, had a neutron star at the core. And that was actually Oppenheimer's first thing. He was trying to predict what size a neutron star would be at the core of the sun, and that led Oppenheimer to actually produce the concept of a black hole by showing that couldn't happen. John Wheeler. Okay, with Bohr, he developed the theory of nuclear fission. Yes?
You say that he didn't get
Right. And you have to remember, back then, there were very few scientists working on this. So somebody would produce, back then would be producing a paper, put together logical statements about this object existing or not existing. And I'm only picking the guys that were kind of right. There was a lot of people that were kind of wrong that don't even make their ways into the history books. Right? So when I pick Wheeler and I pick Lev and I pick Oppenheimer, these are the guys that actually played a role, because the guys I'm picking, I'm going to put together a complete story to take us. My bottom line is I want you to see and be convinced that a black hole does exist, right? Because I can sit there and say, here's a black hole, here's the equations, and I'm done. I want you to see how these guys put together, and they're trying to figure out how astronomy works, how stars live or die, because this creates this object called a black hole. Right? And I can only pick and choose the ones that played a role. And there are probably more people that played tinier roles or even big roles, which I'm not including. Okay? So Wheeler, he's the guy that started categorizing how stars lived or died. He had, like I said before, had that major battle. Now, look at the year we're talking about, 1957. Some of us were around at that time. Okay, so I'm trying to show you how short of a time we're actually talking about here, right? He retracted his argument in about 1960 and became the leading proponent, as you can see, started producing a lot of books. He's the one that coined the phrase black hole, coined the phrase, you may have heard of, a black hole has no hair, and I'll explain what that means later on. So it became the big dude in really pushing forward the work on these objects called black holes. Another character, all right, and a lot of these characters you see have been here, right? It's just that some of them have died since, right? So Roger Penrose, he speculated that black holes lose their hair by radiating it away. He discovered that spinning black holes store energy in the space outside of the horizon. Right, we're into the 1970s now, we're into your parents' time frame. Right, he discovered some property about the surface area of black holes. He proved that black holes must have a singularity at their core. The cosmic censorship conjecture, and he did this by dealing with a totally different form of mathematics called topology. So he approached black holes not from a geometrical perspective, but from a different branch of mathematics called topology, right? And if those of you understand topology allows you to say that this cup and this donut are literally identical from a topological perspective, right? By the way, Penrose diagrams and things like that, something that I've tossed in the sheets for you to play, have a look at, some of the things that are there, okay? So we've got Roger Penrose. And these are some of the other players that have been here and are coming here. Stephen Hawking, Bekenstein, Kip Thorne again, another dude on this book, right? How many people have heard of Kip Thorne? Okay. Kind of nice. What is this picture? They always show this young one when he was like nice and young. You can tell he's young. He's got the gold chain on his chest, right? Right now, you know, he's more mature now. But all these guys put together bits and pieces. They pieced together components of this object, this massive object, which we're calling a black hole. Okay? They're going to tell us not only that how an object like a black hole is created, what it looks like, how it moves, how it dies if it dies, how it interacts. How do we look for it? Do they really exist? So what we're going to do now is put the story together. So I've given you the major characters and some of the major roles, and you get an appreciation that these guys suffered through this. You know, and this may be a good time to break, right? So tomorrow we'll just run through the story. So the story tomorrow will actually take us to a black hole. We'll go through the stellar stuff, figure out what a black hole is, look at it at its anatomy, see what happens when we fall into a black hole, look at the different types of black holes, right? See what the latest computer animations look like for a black hole. But we're at that point where we're right this. We know the players. We've got their 2 cents worth, and we'll put it all together. Okay?